So thank you very much for inviting me to talk about something a little bit different, primordial black holes. So let me start by giving you a very brief historical introduction to primordial black holes. Stephen Hawking, in 1971, wrote a paper titled Gravitationally Collapsed Object of Very Low Mass. And in this paper, first and foremost, he proposed that there might be a large number of gravitationally collapsed objects of mass above the Planck mass in the universe. And secondly, he also proposed how they might form, what we call now primordial black holes. And they could have formed as a result of fluctuations in the early universe. Namely, if you have sufficiently large density fluctuations in the radiation in the early universe, by sufficiently large we mean something like tens of percent, those could collapse to form directly black holes, and we're talking about, you know, microseconds after the Big Bang, hence the name primordial black hole, as opposed to astrophysical, as we've been talking about. The second thing that he said, without using these very words, is that primordial black holes could be the dark matter. So this extra density could stabilize clusters of galaxies which otherwise appear mostly not to be gravitationally bound. So to put things in their historical context, in the early 70s, there was a clear missing mass problem in galaxy clusters, as first measured by Fritz Zwicky. And this was before the rotation curves of galaxies were measured very precisely, but it was clear that there was some missing mass. So Stephen Hawking is arguably one of the first to propose some non-typical, it's not just brown dwarfs or gas, it could be some black holes from the early universe. Another historical character is Bernard Carr, who actually is still, 45 years later, active in the field. Bernard Carr grouped the first observational limits to primordial black hole abundance. So you're going to see another plot like this, where you have, as a function of the mass of the primordial black hole, what is the maximum abundance in terms of the critical density of the universe that it could be made of. And another important point that he made is that observational limits on the spectrum of primordial black holes could place strong constraints on the magnitude of the density fluctuations in the early universe. In other words, even if these primordial black holes are not all of the dark matter, they're still interesting because they tell us something about the early universe. So placed in a bit of a modern context, so first and foremost, almost a century after Fritz Zwicky measured, this anomalous mass, we still don't know what the dark matter is. So any candidate is a good, we'll take any candidate. Secondly, so the simplest, so this what I'm showing here is the RMS pictorially, the RMS initial curvature of perturbation as a function of comoving scale. The simplest model that we have of inflation, the simplest understanding, is that this should be roughly flat over 15 to 25 decades, okay, 40 to 60 e-folds. Now, what we've actually measured from the CMB and large-scale structure, from CMB anisotropies, are just something like three decades of scales, from megaparsecs to gigaparsecs. This level here is something like 10 minus 5 or so. That's the temperature fluctuations of the CMB. We also have some upper limits from CMB spectral distortions, from the fact that the CMB spectrum is almost a perfect black body at the level of a few times 10 minus 3. But otherwise, on smaller scales, this primordial curvature perturbation is essentially unconstrained. Okay, so lots of stuff could hide here. And primordial black holes are presumably one way to learn something about the amplitude of curvature perturbations on small enough scales. So, as I said before, Bernard Carr was the first to show this kind of plots. This is the status as of last month. This is a paper by Sato Polito et al. And so here you have a bunch of constraints. I'll just summarize a few. On the very low mass end, black holes which are lighter than 10 to the 15 grams actually would have evaporated by the age of the universe, and otherwise they can emit Hawking radiation from which we can set some limits. There are lots of limits from microlensing around here. On the high end, Tim Brandt set some limits from dynamical heating of dwarf galaxies, and what I will be focusing on is this mass range from about 1 to 1,000 solar masses. In this mass range, as I said, you have microlensing limits, this ultra-faint dwarf limits, white binaries, and I will talk about the CMB limits, as well as potential limits from LIGO. So let me first tell you about primordial black holes as electromagnetic sources, and more specifically, I will tell you how one can use the anisotropies of the cosmic microwave background to set some limits on how much of the dark matter could be in primordial black holes. So the basic story goes as follows. So suppose some of the dark matter is made of primordial black holes, roughly speaking, randomly distributed. These black holes are not isolated. They are immersed in gas of hydrogen and helium in the early universe. If you put gas around black holes, they will accrete to some level. So a big part of the calculation was to try and estimate how much they actually accrete quantitatively. So the way we did this is by taking a enhanced Bondi Hoyle-Littleton model and adding in the fact that accretion takes place in a bath of CMB photons, which leads to a Compton drag and a Compton cooling. Okay, so what you see in this curve, this is some normalized accretion rates. At early times, accretion is damped because photons exert a drag onto the accreting gas. And at late times, you just have less densities. The universe is expanding and becomes more dilute, and the accretion rate falls down. So these accreting black holes will re-radiate part of the energy that they accrete. And so the second part of the calculation is to try and estimate what is the luminosity of these black holes. So what we did here is to estimate the very minimal possible luminosity of these black holes in order to set conservative constraints. So the way we did this is a la Shapiro, sorry, there was a French accent. No? So a la Shapiro, 73, adding Compton cooling. And again, as a function of redshift, I'm showing here the luminosity of these black holes in terms of Eddington luminosity. I am not an accretion expert, so I always hope that some accretion experts can come and talk to me and tell me how, you know, this can be improved. So the third part of the process is to compute first how this energy is actually deposited into the plasma. And secondly, now we're zooming in. Before it was black holes, now these are representing little neutral hydrogen atoms, and those are little protons and electrons. So all of these photons that these accreting black holes radiate can ionize the gas beyond its normal ionization fraction. So here, what I'm showing is the change in the free electron fraction as a function of redshift once we fold in this energy injection into my recombination code Hyrec. Now, something that I want to emphasize, something you should know, is that the anisotropies of the cosmic microwave background are very sensitive to how exactly the universe recombined. That's something I spent a lot of time on in my PhD when I was down the coast over there with Chris Serrata. So what I'm going to show here, this is the ionization fraction. It's normalized to hydrogen, so it starts at 1.16 because the universe has 8% of helium in number. Then it drops to 1.08, and then it drops to almost zero as the universe recombines, roughly 400,000 years after the Big Bang. This is the temperature power spectrum as a function of multiple moment L of the cosmic microwave background. You're probably familiar with this curve. And this is the polarization power spectrum, and this is the temperature cross-polarization power spectrum. So what I'm going to show is I add a little bump of 10%, and as this bump moves, you'll see that this affects the CMB power spectrum and cross spectra in a very noticeable way. So using this effect, and again, going back here, the fact that these primordial black holes, which accrete and radiate, can increase the free electron fraction above normal. Using this effect, we could compute the change in the CMB temperature and polarization, and also temperature cross-polarization power spectra. And folding in with Planck data, we could set some upper limits on the abundance of primordial black holes as a function of mass, and show that they cannot be all of the dark matter if the black holes are heavier than 100 solar masses. Okay, so now one thing I want to drive home is that the assumptions that went in are simplistic, but we try to be as conservative as possible. We try to estimate everything from first principle and try to be extremely conservative. But again, if there are people who would like to help me think in more detail about this, you're very welcome. So one more thing is that one thing we're working on with the students, so this is all with the CMB power spectrum, the two-point function, assuming the CMB remains Gaussian. And one other thing I'm working on is that, in fact, this will also induce non-Gaussianities in the CMB, and something I can also tell you about if you're interested. So let me talk more now about gravitational wave sources, which is the main goal of this meeting. So there are two channels that have been discussed to form primordial black hole binaries. The first one, in this paper by Simeon Bird et al., of which I was part, as well as this other paper by Kless and Garcia Bellido, is a channel to form primordial black hole binaries in the modern day universe. The basic process is just the gravitational wave equivalent of radiative recombination. If you have 2-point masses, which pass by each other on a hyperbolic orbit, you can compute the time-varying quadrupole moment. It makes for an excellent homework for GR class, and you can estimate the cross-section, and it's something like 45 times m squared, v to the minus 18th sevenths. This was actually computed by Shapiro, Kunoyan Shapiro, in 89. So take this cross-section, multiply sigma by v times n. This gives you the merger rate per black hole. Do this times the number of black hole in any given halo of black holes, times the number of halo per unit volume in the modern day universe. And this gives you the merger rate per unit volume. Again, so this the picture here is that in the present day universe, most of the dark matter is part of halos, and so would be primordial black holes. And then to compute how frequently they merge, we just multiply the merger rate per halo times the number of halo. Doing this calculation, what we found is that the merger rate, if all of the dark matter was in primordial black holes, the merger rate would be something around 0.1 to 1 per gigaparsec cube per year, which is roughly comparable, you know, it's not 7 orders of magnitude away from what LIGO estimates. And it turns out, so in this more recent paper, we recomputed this by accounting for the fact that the mass function will be drastically modified because of the fact that primordial black holes induce a Poisson clustering, a shot noise on small scales. And so actually we find that every single one of these pieces is drastically modified by like 3 orders of magnitude, but it sort of compensates to give you back the same number. We could call this the PBH miracle. So this is, as I said, a one way to form binaries in the late universe. It turns out that there's another way, which is way, way more efficient, on which I'm going to focus for the rest of the talk. So you will form binaries, it's unavoidable, in the early universe. And this is something that was first computed by Nakamura, Sasaki, and Thorne in 97, that we recently revisited with Eli Kovets and Mark Kaminkowski. The basic idea is as follows. Again, imagine that your primordial black holes are roughly randomly distributed on small scales. I've just colored here a pair of black holes which happen to be born close enough to one another, that they will decouple from the Hubble flow at some point. Now, instead of falling head-on onto one another, they're going to be torqued by the other primordial black holes. They will also be torqued by the overall density fluctuations, the overall tidal field around them, and so they will gain some angular momentum. So they're not going to collapse head-on, but they're going to form some eccentric binary. And then this eccentric binary, the story goes, will just in spiral slowly until it merges at some point in the history of the universe. This is a mathematical rendition of the story I just told you, which is semi-realistic. So simulators, please don't laugh. All right. So what are the ingredients in the calculation in a bit more detail? So first, we need some initial spatial distribution of these primordial black holes. So again, we assume that they are randomly distributed. That's a very simple assumption, and I'll get back to this in a minute. Given this random distribution, one can compute from first principle, one can follow a nearest neighbor pair as it decouples through the Hubble flow. So this is some dimensionless separation as a function of dimensionless time, if you want. So at first it follows the Hubble flow and then decouples and forms a bound system. So this depends on how close the nearest neighbor is separated, and so we can use this to compute the distribution of initial semi-major axes. Then, given the distribution of other primordial black holes, we can compute the torque that they induce, and we can, as a result, compute the distribution of angular momentum of these binaries. So the bottom line is that we obtain a probability distribution of initial semi-major axes and initial eccentricities, from which the merger time, something that is known since the 60s, scales as 8^4 times. This is basically a normalized dimensionless angular momentum to the 7th. So from this, we can get a distribution of merger time. As a consequence, one can compute the stochastic gravitational wave background that these primordial black hole binaries would generate, and also the merger rate at the present time, which it turns out is much more constraining than the stochastic gravitational wave background. So I told you before that the merger rate in the present day universe, if all of the dark matter was in primordial black holes, you would get something that's 0.1 to 1 per gigaparsec cube per year. In this case, if all of the dark matter is in primordial black holes as a function of the mass of the black hole, you get something that's between 10^4 and 10^6 per gigaparsec cube per year. So as I said, this is, in this case, many orders of magnitude beyond what LIGO should have seen. So these are upper limits. So this is from 2017. Some of them are directly computed by the LIGO collaboration. Some of them are inferred from the volume, the horizon distance that they provide for different masses. So turning this around, we can turn these estimated merger rates into an upper limit on how much of the dark matter, the maximum fraction of the dark matter, that can be made of primordial black hole as a function of their masses. Okay. And so if you take these limits to face value, these are actually the most stringent, this is actually the most sensitive probe of primordial black holes in roughly, if you could, you can extend this from one to several hundred solar masses. Now, of course, there are lots of caveats, which is why these limits are possible limits. And so there are lots of things to check before we declare them robust limits. So the first step I told you about is the initial spatial distribution of primordial black holes. So there was a lot of debate in the community due to some papers which were made some mistakes. I showed recently that on general basis, indeed, they should be random. Primordial black holes should be born randomly distributed. And this was confirmed by Steros et al. And Dejac and Liotto in, with more detailed calculations recently. So this should be a rather safe assumption. The second step is to compute the initial distribution of orbital parameters, something which we had to put in a lot of assumptions into. Recently, Rydell et al. Did 70 body simulations all the way to redshift 1000. What they did is that they randomly distributed 68 black holes, computed the tidal torque at a given point, placed the remaining two black holes in the middle with a separation and orientation such that if the analytic approximations are correct, this binary should merge precisely in a Hubble time. Okay? So this was a way to check for self-consistency. So what they found is that if primordial black holes make 10% or less of the dark matter, then indeed our analytic approximations are self-consistent. However, if they make more than this, then they found that in some cases the binary got circularized so much that it actually merges in much longer than the Hubble time. Remember that the merger time goes as angular momentum to the 7th power. They also find that in some cases the binary is actually disrupted by the other primordial black holes. So the bottom line is that if you have a fraction above 10%, actually our results still need to be double-checked. And the reason is that for a fraction above 10%, the typical initial separation of nearest neighbor binaries that would merge at the present time happens to be a factor of 3 or so lower than the mean primordial black hole, mean separation between primordial black holes. So there's not enough separation between the two, and the whole thing basically is nonlinear. So that's something that is in principle calculable, but that remains to be done more accurately. Another question is, so whether binaries, actually, even if we assume that we have computed their distribution correctly, whether they actually survive between the formation time and the merger time. So this is the characteristic formation redshift as a function of the fraction of dark matter in primordial black holes. And what I'm showing here is that these binaries form very early in the history of the universe, typically before matter-radiation equality. and all the way up to maybe redshift of several hundreds of thousands. And one can compute also the characteristic initial semi-major axis and the characteristic initial eccentricity for the binaries that would merge today. The main message here is that these binaries have a very small, typically very small angular momentum, i.e. are typically highly eccentric at formation. And so highly eccentric binaries are fragile to torques. So for example, one of the questions is, can accretion of gas onto the binary significantly torque this binary and, you know, change its angular momentum and make it merge in a much longer time? So that's something that we made some really crude estimates for. And again, if anyone would like to help with this, that would be great. And what we concluded is that for most values of the masses of the primordial black holes, it should be okay. The binaries should not be torqued more than what they started with. But if the numbers here are factors of 10 or 100, which is possible, then for sufficiently large primordial black holes, these circumbinary accretion torques might actually be significant. So that's something to be checked. And if there's anyone who's interested, please come and talk to me. Another thing is, so if primordial black holes are not all of the dark matter, the rest of the dark matter is going to do something. So these, for example, these are simulations by Kavanagh et al., where they had some halo of WIMP-like particle dark matter around primordial black holes and checked how this affected the evolution of binaries. The result is that this will, on the one hand, shrink the typical orbits, but also make them more circularized. And as a consequence, because merger time goes as a to the fourth times j to the seventh, it overall compensates, and the merger rate is basically unaffected, which is kind of miraculous. Last but not least, what's the effect of the first nonlinear structures? So that's something that we spent a lot of time in this paper with Kovets and Kamienkowski to try and estimate analytically, to try and figure out what were the properties of the first halos, et cetera, and whether this could affect these first binaries. But something I want to do now more carefully is to do it numerically. And that's something I started doing with Derek Inman, who's a postdoc at NYU. So these are snapshots of simulations, all of them at redshift 100, with different fractions of dark matter in the form of primordial black holes. And as you increase this fraction, you see that the universe becomes more and more grainy, and you have more and more Poisson fluctuations, which themselves will generate structure through gravitational collapse, through gravitational instability. So this is just to show you a movie of these simulations, which starts at redshift about 2 million, and then evolve, in this case, 10 to the 5 primordial black holes, as well as 256 cubed particle dark matter particles. Okay, so the goal is to have simulations which account for having a mixture of primordial black holes and particle-like dark matter. I will leave you with my conclusions, which I will summarize here. So first, we asked a couple of years ago whether LIGO detected dark matter. It is not excluded. The reason is that LIGO is actually likely the most sensitive probe of primordial black holes in the range of one to a few hundred solar masses. So one cannot exclude that LIGO, in principle, has detected dark matter. However, if it is so, most likely it would be a highly subdominant part of the dark matter. Okay? Our original paper did calculations assuming that all of the dark matter was in primordial black holes, and assuming that binaries formed in the late universe, it turns out that binaries forming in the early universe, this is a much more efficient channel, and as a consequence, you can be under the LIGO rate only if you have 1% or lower of primordial black holes in dark matter. So there are lots of tests that have been proposed to try and figure out whether observed events are primordial or not, but I think first things first, as I try to explain, there are lots of uncertainties that need to be checked first in the merger rate. And that's something that we want to do, among other things, with simulations. And last, I want to mention that there are also electromagnetic signatures of primordial black holes, both in individual black holes and in binaries. For example, the how efficiently they accrete and what is their luminosity is something that would need to be addressed with the simulations. And the last thing we want to do here with the simulations is also add gas to see how these highly nonlinear structures on small scales might affect, for example, the formation of the first stars. I will stop here and take any questions.
Thank you. Question set. Tessa?
Thanks. So regarding the cosmological bounds on how much dark matter can be made of primordial black holes, you spoke about the anisotropies in the CMB.
Yes.
But you didn't say anything about the matter power spectrum, which sort of instinctively one thinks should be the strongest, the quantity most strongly affected by that. So are there no bounds from the matter power spectrum?
There is a bound by Niyash Afshordi and David Spergel, and I might be missing a third author, from the Lyman Alpha Forest, which comes from the fact that if you have, again, discrete dark matter particles, you will generate Poisson noise on small enough scales. But this bound only kicks in above 10 to the 4 solar masses. So maybe, let me see if I understand your question. Maybe you're asking if you affect the CMB, you also affect large-scale structure.
I'm more thinking about late times, right? If I've got my dark matter or some substantial fraction of it in black holes, so they're massive objects, you know, think of them as really massive particles, compared to WIMPs, say. I've got dark matter which is very strongly concentrated in these big things rather than a very diffuse distribution of WIMPs. And that's something that I would perhaps, you know, without having calculated anything, intuitively think would affect the two-point correlation function of structure.
But so when we talk about two-point correlation, we talk about megaparsec scales. When you look at megaparsec scales, whether the dark matter is made of, you know, particles which are solar mass or proton mass, makes very little difference.
Okay. I mean, we do go down to...
But if you go down to very small scales, which I was showing before, so all the way to the end, so these images here... So it's only if you go down, in this case, these boxes are 30 kiloparsec cube co-moving. It's only if you go down to sufficiently small scales, which we don't necessarily observe directly, that you can start seeing the fact that you have a finite mass. But on, you know, if you look at SDSS, distribution of galaxies and things like this, it will not be affected.
Huh, okay, all right, thanks. No.
Dan.
So just a question about rate evolution. So in general, for this, the rate evolution with redshift. We're starting to be able, to constrain that say, you know, suppose we find that there are a lot, the merger rates go up as you go up in redshift. Is there sort of a generic prediction that it's relatively insensitive to redshift? Locally, how does that look?
I don't have this, but I can point you to references. This is computable, it's easy to compute, and it is very different than astrophysical black holes, of course, because they were merging throughout the history of the universe.
All the way back.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be some power law dependence rather than, you know, a sharp bump, right?
Alberto.
Yeah. I was curious, I mean, I know zero about primordial black holes. So I was curious about how you compute these primordial binaries, and you know, and you get these rates that are very high if everything is made, all dark matter is made by these primordial black holes. It sounds like that should be very sensitive to the exact moment when you form those black holes, right? The relative separation that they have, how often you form binaries.
Yeah.
So is that something that is known by, I don't know, energy scale arguments? So if this is the mass, this is the typical separation. What are the kind of assumptions that
Right. So the simple argument, so the Nakamura et al. Paper gave the simple argument. When will, if I have two-point masses in an expanding universe, when will they fall back onto one another?
Right.
And basically, it's when the mass that is within, you know, the mass of both matter plus radiation that is enclosed within this orbit becomes less than the mass of the objects, then they will feel each other more than, you know, the expansion.
Sure.
This plot is actual computation of this. So if you give me an initial separation of two-point masses in an otherwise expanding universe, one can compute from first principles, you just solve Einstein's equations, and then they will follow the expansion and then fall back.
Sure.
And you can make analytical estimates, and I can show you more if you want.
can follow up.
So I guess thinking forward to a wonderful epic when things are really well localized, should these binary black holes just follow the dark matter distribution, or do they pay any attention to baryons, for example? If one asks about the volume, are they more concentrated in galaxies than dark matter at all?
So you're asking if there's a preferential site of forming binaries in the early universe.
Right. I mean, the tidal torques are mainly between them, but obviously if they're in an over-density, they're a little bit enhanced. And
yes,
so I was
just
wondering if there's any correlation beyond just the dark matter.
That's a good question. I don't know. Yeah, it could be. I don't know. I suspect that the tidal torque is... Well, the tidal torque is dominated by the nearest neighbor rather than, you know, the galaxy scale. I suspect...
The nearest neighbor is a little bit nearer to the density.
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
Yes?
All right, building off on what Alberto was asking about. So in your model, how large were the accretion rates in your model? I was just worried that with a large enough accretion rate, that would affect the dynamics of the binary and possibly the merger rate as well.
I am very much worried about this too. So that's as I said, something we made some very simple. Where is it? Yes. So the accretion rate is very small compared. The luminosity is typically sub-Eddington. The accretion rate is like Bondi. I mean, I can give you some numbers. That's the plot I showed initially. In here. I don't know if this speaks to you. So this is accretion rate divided by L Eddington, you know, with the C squared factors. I don't know if this answers your question or...
Yeah, it looks smaller.
What, small compared to what? I don't know.
It's much smaller than mine.
Right, but over, is it the orbital period that matters or is it the Hubble time? Because if it's the latter, then you're, yeah. So that's the kind of things I'm worried about, and it could be, even with a small accretion rate, it could overall add up.
Alberto.
So just maybe for everybody. I mean, there is of course many channels to form black hole binaries. Is there anything that, you know, will make you jump out of your chair and say, okay, this is a primordial black hole? Is there anything specific prediction that might, you know, tell you that you've seen a primordial black hole binary rather than, you know, something forming a cluster or something?
If it's if it's 0.5 solar masses.
Masses.
Fair. That's one specific one, I guess.
But the cosmic evolution itself, you said, that would be very different, right?
The cosmic evolution, yeah.
I want to ask something similar, which is, you know, do you expect hierarchical merging? I mean, what fraction of your primordial black holes are in these? Is it a small fraction, so you expect that you're only going to get 1 + 1 or
Yeah, that's related to the question on whether these binaries get affected later on by large-scale structure. I don't have an answer to this question.
Okay. Because, I mean, in that case, you expect a different spin distribution. Is that coming from multiple chains of mergers, right?
So Mehrdad Mirbabayi and Andrei Gusinov worked on the spin from this idea that you form these black holes out of the collapse of, you know, 10% density fluctuations, and they estimate that the spin is quadratic in the initial curvature, and so the typical spins they estimate is parametrically of order 1%, the individual spins of the black hole. So the lore, which I haven't done any calculation myself, but the standard lore in the topic is that they're non-spinning or very little spinning.
If you merge two of them, then suddenly now you're spinning. And
so I see.
If you have more than one.
Yeah.
Okay, one last question.
So I had a question that was kind of going in the direction of Alberto, but on the opposite end. So what do you think it would take actually to rule out completely the primordial black holes?
Well, I mean, you can only set, I think it's the kind of things where you can only set an upper limit on their abundance.
Yeah, and when would you stop believing? I mean, when are these limits essentially? That's what I'm trying to say.
What do you mean stop believing the limits? What, like you're asking how...
It's all constraining essentially that we don't consider that anymore.
I think it's... Personally, when I get bored, but I don't know if there's... I don't know if there's a... There's no like target number. You know, it's like non-Gaussianities in the CMB. There's like one target number, which is of order one. But then if you don't detect something at order one, how low do you go? You know, there's unfortunately, there's some of those numbers where there's no clear target here. Yeah.
Okay, after this lively discussion, let's thank Yassine again. And all the other speakers of the afternoon. Are there any announcements?